Teboho Alan, how many members of parliament do we have connected?
Good morning, Chair. Alan, now there's six members on the platform. No
Six.
apologies.
We have six members.
That's right, Chair.
Okay, we'll have to start with our meeting. Good morning, honorable members, officials from Treasury and other officials from government departments who might be in attendance, officials from Parliament. You are all welcome. Today's meeting is about the briefing by National Treasury on the Financial Sector Laws Amendment Bill, briefing by Dr. George on the Pensions Funds Amendment Bill, and briefing by Honorable E. Lewis on the Fiscal Responsibility Bill. So that's the agenda of, the purpose of today's meeting. In terms of the agenda is the opening, welcome, apologies, briefing by Treasury, Dr. George, Honorable Lewis, discussions, closure. The meeting is officially open. You are all welcome. Are there apologies? Alan, you said there are no apologies.
Yes, Chair, we haven't received any apologies.
Okay, thanks. Let's proceed to item two. Briefing by National Treasurer on the Financial Sector Laws Amendment Bill, B15-2020. Who's doing the briefing? Alan, table.
Chair.
Yes, Mr. Momoniat, over to you.
Morning, honorable members, and yet another bill for your consideration today. Chair, and thank you. Chair, what we have today is the Financial Sector Laws Amendment Bill. It basically is an amendment bill to deal with resolution for bank debts in financial distress. I think honourable members may know that just generally, when any bank, when there's even a whiff of a story that a bank is in trouble, people rush to a bank to cash out. And no bank, by definition, will have all the deposits that it has from depositors available to be paid out if everybody comes for it at one time. They'll only have a very small percentage of their total deposits because, as you know, they make loans from those deposits. So, Chair, for that reason, in addition to normal insolvency that you have, you find that banks can be put under a form of curatorship. Now, that is there in the current act and certainly dealt with, for example, the crises we had recently of African Bank, of VBS, and so on. What we're now doing today and what this bill does is to step up what's called the resolution regime for banks and other financial institutions, and I'll deal with it in more detail. It also introduces, Chair and honorable members, a deposit insurance. South Africa is one of the few G20 countries that doesn't have a deposit insurance. And what that means is for every depositor, there's a small insurance that's paid. And this fund is the first fund that we'll use to in the event of any bank failure where we have to pay out depositors. Members would know that which at the moment we don't have a formal deposit insurance system, but we have an informal one where we generally have paid out to depositors, for example, at BBS and at African Bank, which would be, if I remember, we normally go for about 100,000 per depositor, for retail depositors. So up to that amount is kind of implicitly guaranteed for depositors, and the state comes in on that. And I'll deal with why we do it and so on. So Chair, what I'm going to do today, so basically the bill that you have amends many bills like the Banks Act and other bills, Companies Act and so on, to reinforce the framework that we have. And before going into it, and I don't know if the presentation is up, I can't see it. Is the presentation up for honorable members?
Mama, it's Alan. Cindy asked out there. It's on.
Okay. And apologies, we just made a few small changes, so it may differ slightly from what members have had. So, Chair, just to let you know who's on, and there may be others, but from the Treasury, it's myself, it's Fukile Davidson, Janine Benagiosi, and Langele Kabindi. And we've got colleagues from the Reserve Bank, Nicola Brum, Jacques Bortes, Hendrik Nell, Sabina Mohammed, Masenya Masemole, and Pregasin Mudli. There may be other colleagues who would also join us, and some of them may even join us later as we respond to comments and so on. So, Chair, just to move on, so we've got a pretty big delegation because, next slide, please. And next slide. I think just to provide the background, the one before, sorry. So, Chair, I thought I would just quickly go through just a bit of background for honorable members. Honorable members must would know that after the 2008 global financial crisis, which really was a significant event, it was a kind of 1-in-100-year event when you had such a massive banking crisis in the world. Of course, COVID has now become a worse crisis. It's not necessarily a financial crisis. It's an economic crisis, certainly, but so far not a financial crisis. But what we learned from the global financial crisis, in fact, we had almost forgotten the kind of big crash and problems that you had in the early 1930s, because many of us were in this room and watching it were unlikely to be around. There'll be very few people who were around, and they'd obviously be at least 90 plus years. And even then they would have been infants. So in a sense, the world had forgotten just how bad a financial crisis is. And the entire, and though the crisis was with a US bank, it quickly spread to other banks in the US. It quickly spread to other banks in Europe and in other parts of the world. And I'll come to that. And basically, when you have a bank that's in trouble, it's a systemic, it can very quickly become a systemic crisis because banks themselves are interconnected. So if one major bank fails, you're going to find all your other major banks will also fail because there may be deposits of the one bank in the other. Or their clients have deposits in one, loans from the other, they can't pay, and so on. And in response to that crisis, because South African banks largely were safe and well-regulated and didn't take the risk that the U.S. banks had taken, we were able to wait a bit and see what was happening and how other countries were responding. And let me say that, you know, up to then, Chair and honorable members, the G20 used to only be a forum for the ministers of finance. But with the crisis in the US, heads of state attending this forum and created a higher forum than ministers of finance. And since then, you've had the G20 heads of state. And their basic mission at that point was to save the world from this global crisis that we were seeing. And what happened was, in South Africa, we waited till 2011 when we published a document which Cabinet approved called A Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better. And I would still advocate that members read this. It is on our website. So Cabinet adopted this policy, and it basically laid the basis for setting up the Twin Peak system, where we stepped up the power of the Registrar of Banks and converted them into the Prudential Authority to look at the financial health, of financial institutions, including banks. So what they would do is they would assess, can a bank deliver on its promise that if it holds your deposit and it says you can come and collect your deposit anytime, that it can actually deliver on that promise? Can a retirement fund deliver on its promise when you retire in 30 or 40 years' time that your pension will still be there and be able to pay out? So it deals with financial wellness. As opposed to, we also created a market conduct regulator to protect customers, because financial institutions are very powerful. No customer can fight their bank on their own unless they're very, very, very rich. And so we created the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. We converted the old Financial Services Board to ensure that their focus would just be our banks not just treating their customers fairly, but also that the way they conduct their business doesn't exploit whole classes of their customers. And that's why I think I'm personally very excited by this conduct authority. And, it's still early days, but that is the real protective mechanism for financial sector customers, including banking customers. Linked to that, there's the financial sector ombud system. There's a tribunal. There's a whole lot of mechanisms to protect customers in that bill. So you can move on to the next slide. So what we did in South Africa, and just to bear in mind that we've got at least 10 acts of parliament which specifically deal with the financial sector. So they apply to banks mainly. Not mainly, to others as well. But and most, except for one of these acts, they're all administered by the Minister of Finance. So you'll have a Banks Act, you'll have an Insurance Act, you'll have a Collective Investment Schemes Act, you'll have the FICE Act. You've got many acts. And there's a National Credit Act, which falls under the Minister of Trade and Industry. So what we then did was, we published a range of papers and a framework papers after 2011. And in fact, we have one or two major bills still left. There's a so-called coffee bill, which is the conduct of financial institutions bill, which we hope to bring to, it's been published for comment, which we hope to bring to the Standing Committee of Finance, to Parliament later this year. And that is, I think, after the Financial Sector Regulation Act, probably one of the major pieces of financial legislation. We've also had more technical papers on the resolution framework. So coming back to the crisis, there were a whole lot of lessons that were learned about how to better deal with banking crisis, especially, and to generalize that to financial institutions. And the issue really was that because the financial crisis in any of the advanced economies can very quickly become an international crisis. And bear in mind that though our banks were safe, the impact of what happens in the financial sector hits the economy of that country. So the financial crisis in the U.S. hit the U.S. economy. It then had a double effect on other economies because it firstly created a banking crisis in the Eurozone, and it also led to the fact that when the US economy goes into a recession, it impacts on the rest of the world. And you have that with major economies like the US and now China and Europe. When their economies go down, it impacts on us very significantly. And what happened was, though our banks remained safe from the financial crisis, we still had a recession. And over 1 million South Africans lost their jobs, even though our banks were safe, our financial sector was safe. Just to give you a sense of how wide this is. And largely because, you know, banking risk is different from other risks. It's linked to the sovereign risk. Your banks hold lots of government bonds, and there is what you call a doom loop, that if you have a banking crisis, it impacts on your sovereign risk, and it impacts on the fiscus, and it creates an economic crisis. Similarly, if you have if your economy is in trouble for a prolonged period, it can lead to a banking crisis, especially if your sovereign bonds ratings go down, your banking ratings go down, the cost of capital goes up. And so this doom loop is something you have to watch for and what actually gets government to intervene. And it's called a moral hazard problem, because if you don't intervene, your problem will get worse. And because of that, your major banks can almost hold the country to ransom because they can take more risk than they should, knowing that the sovereign will come in. And I think a good example of that was the Eurozone crisis, which became a bigger crisis for those countries than even the crisis in the US. And in fact, it was called the pigs initially. Someone's made a mistake there. It should be PIIGS, not P2Gs, because it covered, you know, if you remember, it was Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And they started having problems in refinancing either their sovereign debt or bailing out their banks. And so these bank weaknesses, you know, create huge costs for the government. And over the past three decades, you know, banking crises have contributed to large increases in public debt. And for that reason, you find that governments are forced to come in. It's almost like having a gun to your head. If you don't, it's going to be a worse crisis. So you're forced to come in. And generally, financial crises, if they are the cause of a recession, it takes much longer for the economy to get back to recovery. Next slide. So banking crises are directly connected to a fiscal crisis. And, you know, you can look at all the studies of 187 banking crises. In fact, after 2008, there were lots and lots of books on the banking crisis, so that at least for the next, I would guess, 40 years, we'll remember the crisis, and then we'll begin to forget and probably have another big one. But that's the sort of crisis you have, and it has huge effect even in declines in average life expectancy, primary school enrollments, because it impacts on the economy, impacts on poverty and income inequality and so on. Next slide. And for that reason, Chair, when, you know, we presented for the Twin Peaks, we used to say that, you know, banks are like almost like a nuclear risk to the economy. Just like you wouldn't, if you've got a nuclear facility, you make sure that you monitor it intrusively, intensively. The world began to realize that banks also pose, obviously not the same directly in terms of death and getting people physically sick, but in terms of the economy, its impact can be as devastating. And you therefore, two concepts came up and they are linked, that there are some banks that are too big to fail. No country will allow that, can allow them to fail, because as I said, it will get into a worse crisis. And they described as systemically important financial institutions. So they call SIFIs. And I think that's an important word, shorthand to remember what a SIFI is. It refers to a systemically important financial institution. And that just takes into account that there's a domino effect. One bank, major bank goes, you're going to find the other banks go. You're going to find it impacts on other financial institutions that are related, and the whole problem of moral hazard. And in fact, the thing that we don't like about this problem is that when there are profits to be made, they obviously go to the shareholders of a bank. Okay, so your profits are definitely privatized. But when a major bank is in trouble, when there are losses, then society has to take the cost. And that's the problem that we're trying to deal with and to prevent. Next slide. So the global financial crisis was certainly a wake-up call, and we found that it extends not just to the domestic economy, but can grow to be a global crisis. And that's why in 2009, as I said, the G20 started meeting with the heads of state. And in fact, I think the first one was attended by former President Motlanthe. He attended one of them. We remember that because I think Barack Obama attended that one or the one after. And in 2009, I think that's when he came in. And you have a whole lot of international initiatives. In fact, South Africa was not part of the Financial Services Board, as it was called. And Financial Services Forum, I think it was called. It's now called, it changed its name. And we kind of became members. And in these forums, we looked at all these problems. There's a whole set of initiatives came out. These were adopted and supported by, for example, in the Seoul Summit in 2010, and your SIFI framework emerged. And basically, one of the big issues was that banks must do resolution planning, or to have what's called a living will. So for example, in the US and many other countries now, most G20 countries, there's a mandatory annual submission that if you're a major SIFI bank, that you have to submit to the regulators, which kind of plans that in case you have financial problems, that you have an orderly dissolution. And that's what we're going to deal with today. Next slide. So again, I won't go through all of these. I think I've made these points that banks are really different, not just from other companies, but from other financial institutions as well. They work on trust, and that's why you had forums like the Financial Stability Board, which is the forum I was talking about, which through the G20 dealt with cross-border resolution, reduction of moral hazard. Next slide. Okay. Your legal framework for crisis intervention, your deposit insurance, all of these. And in South Africa, though we moved and we changed to Basel III, we put in a whole lot of new measures to hold capital and more capital by banks. We haven't really moved on the resolution and deposit insurance framework, and we're now quite an outlier. So today's bill, Chair, will deal with those two issues. Next slide. Okay. These are just all the things that we did, the changes since 2011, aside from the document a safer financial sector. We've had to make lots of amendments to Act, especially to the Banks Act. We've made a few changes, especially to deal with African bank, pay to good bank, bad bank. We've had framework papers on deposit insurance. And I should add, Chair, that all of these are available and on our website, but we could make it easier and perhaps just provide a page of all the links for all these documents so that members could go through all of these documents. Next slide. Okay, so Chair, let me now just deal with the financial sector. Oh, sorry. So this was the FSRA Act, which gave the Reserve Bank the additional mandate to oversee financial stability, to look at systemic events, and to also the governor of the SARB designates which institutions are SIFIs. Next slide. So, Chair, these are the issues that this bill will address. Maybe I'll ask one of our team to come in. I don't know, Lange or Bukele, do you want to come in and maybe do the slides in a bill since you've done most of the work? Lange or Bukele?
Hi, Mama. I was just sort of trying to unmute myself. It's going to be, I can happily take you through the next couple of slides. As I am managing the slides, I won't be able to see what's going on. So please just jump in if I need to stop or go back or anything like that.
Okay.
So as Mama, I think, has sort of taken us through the rationale for why this bill is important, and he very sort of eloquently
Bukele, I'm
described,
not sure, but I can't see the slide. The slide up still then.
Ah yes, sir. Let me. Apologies. Let me carry on sharing.
Okay, if you have difficulty, I can go through it, but just try.
Is that okay?
Yeah, we can see it now.
Okay, excellent. As I was saying, so Momo described the path that's taken us to where we are right now. He described the central importance of financial institutions to the economy more broadly, and individuals in the economy. It's where people deposit their wages. It's how we facilitate payments, and that is really the systemic importance of financial institutions. Banks, there's also different types of systemically important institutions like the JSC, as well as large insurers and asset managers, and all of these are basically institutions that are large enough, interconnected enough, and complex enough to cause a broad problem in the financial sector should they fail. Mama also touched on the international work and described the linkages that crises emanating from other countries can have inside of South Africa and vice versa as well. South Africa's financial system is central to our neighbors, specifically, particularly those who are part of the common monetary area. So we not only have a responsibility to make sure that the financial systems are safe for our citizens, but it's any sort of disruption would cause a problem regionally and probably more largely on the continent. And that's really the reason why international coordination has been such a big part of the policy journey so far. So what problem will we be addressing? What we want to do in this bill is to minimize recourse to public funds. And this is to address the moral hazard problem that Momo described. And that is that In good times, it is the creditors and shareholders of the bank that enjoy the profits. Yet in bad times, often the public purse has to step in and help out specific groups, namely ordinary depositors. So that is and as outlined, the cost of these failures are obviously borne by the general public. So that's a big pillar of what we're trying to do. A big part of that is planning for failure. So very often the largest financial institutions are very complex and have intricate ties to other financial institutions, both domestically and internationally. So a big part of what the bill aims to introduce is to make SIFIs resolvable. And that is really to place them and to plan for their death to, in case of their failure, I'm choosing death in that term, to ensure that they, to minimize the disruption to the broader economy. To do this, the resolution framework will do four main things. It will adopt what is called bail-in instead of what we have used in the past, which is bail-out. This is rather identifying a set of liabilities on the bank balance sheet that are specifically designed to absorb losses and therefore take the place of any additional funds or additional funds that the public fiscus would otherwise have to commit to make sure the institution remains stable. The next thing is the need for complex SIFIs to plan for the possibility of failure. This is resolution planning. And that is to make sure that in case of failure, there is an orderly and feasible resolution. The next thing is the need for depositor and protection protection and recognition, and the recognition of this in liquidation processes. And that is why, as Momo said in the top of the presentation, there will be other tweaks to related legislation to make this possible, namely the Insolvency Act and Companies Act. Lastly, there is a need for a legal framework that goes beyond ordinary curatorship and business rescue provision. And this is due to the central nuclear facility-like or systemic nature of financial institutions. There are additional powers are required to make sure that policy, that regulators rather, have sufficient toolkit to effect the resolution of complex institutions. So I'll now speak a little bit about the current legal gaps in South Africa with respect to resolution. So the Banks Act only provides for curatorship, which is limited in scope and does not apply to non-bank financial institutions and to allow for the planning of their failures. And these are obviously the systemic important financial institutions that we referred to earlier. In addition, the Companies Act provides for a business rescue proceedings, but does not give due regard for the nature of complexities of large, complex financial institutions. And maybe just to expand on that point, and that's because banks are not really like ordinary businesses. They have what we call critical functions, and those functions are, for instance, allowing the payment system to continue to operate. So in part, the bill will allow for failure of a bank that happens, but maintain its critical functions, like allowing payments to be made or customers to still meet their obligations to pay rent, to pay for transport, school fees, element that that seeks to address. The Insolvency Act only applies to liquidation proceedings, but does not recognize depositor as a preferred creditor. This was the main thrust of the 2015 Banks Act Amendment Bill. We then tried to clarify the creditor hierarchy to ensure that there was sufficient liabilities available for us to protect depositors in part. So the proposal that is now in front of you will seek to formalize this and entrench this in the law. In addition, there's no pre-identified resolution authority with commensurate powers and functions to deal with group-wide resolution for financial conglomerates. In South Africa, banks are usually part of complex financial conglomerates made up of insurers, asset managers, banks, and banks themselves. Right now, we don't have any powers to be able to deal with the complex financial conglomerates and the relationship that these companies have with each other within conglomerate structures. Again, this was a problem that we encountered in African Bank. There, the other part of that conglomerate happened to be a furniture business in the form of Ellerines, I believe. But the linkages between these two companies created problems for us when we tried to resolve the institution, and this bill will provide powers and measures and tools rather for the regulators to be able to resolve financial conglomerates. Lastly, there's a recognition that there's just a fragmentation in the law and there needs to be alignment and cooperation provisions between regulators. In particular, this relates to the Prudential Authority within the Reserve Bank, the Reserve Bank itself. But not only that, there are tools that would allow facilitation of resolution that reside in other regulators that MoMA had described earlier as part of the compete framework, namely the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. To proceed, so there are no legal provisions for resolutions planning for banks currently, or systemically important non-bank financial institutions and their holding companies. I touched on this earlier. Bailouts are based on a case-by-case basis and not in accordance with the uniform standard or principle defined in law. This is another feature that the bill will introduce. I've also touched on this, that there's a lack of depositor protection in resolution and liquidation. And lastly, that South Africa does not have an explicit privately funded deposit insurance scheme. And MoMA touched on this earlier, but an important feature of the deposit insurance scheme is that it will be private funded, a sort of forced savings mechanism for the financial sector or specifically banks in case we need to compensate depositors in the event of failure. I'm not just going to sort of just take you through the sort of key objectives schematically of the bill, and there are sort of four main pillars. The first is to provide a framework for the resolution of banks and non-banks and SIFIs. The second is to designate the Reserve Bank as the resolution authority with commensurate powers, and some of those I've described. The third pillar is the establishment of this deposit insurance fund and cooperation. And the last pillar is the creation of a creditor hierarchy to to ensure depositors are protected, are further protected in liquidation. And this adds another layer of protection in addition to the depositor insurance. So the depositor insurance scheme allows for compensation of depositors through this sort of forced saving mechanism. And then their preference in liquidation allows them beyond the sort of coverage amount to benefit from, to essentially stand first in line for the parts of the bank that are salvaged in liquidation. I'm just going to now briefly describe the key elements of the bill. So clause 1 to 15, these are various technical amendments, and this will include insolvency amendments to the over-the-counter derivatives. Clause 51 is the meat of the bill that we're presenting today, and those are the resolution elements that we've, that Moma has described, as well as the introduction of the deposit insurance aspect, which we've also described. And then lastly, clause 52 to 61 are the long title amendments and the general amendments. So what are the key proposals? And when, and we've kind of gone through this before, and Moma has kind of alluded to this as he provided a history and the rationale for the bill. I'll perhaps it's worthwhile just going through them again. So the bill aims to enhance the Reserve Bank's financial stability mandate and expand its objectives for depositor protection. Secondly, the scope of application will be for all banks. We have designated all banks as systemically important, and this is because even small banks that don't have large amounts of customers are closely linked and interconnected to other banks. And confidence problems in a small bank can easily spill over to larger banks. It's sort of an analogy that we often use is that it addresses a fire at even though there is no fire in your house, you still have an interest in ensuring that the fire at your neighbor's house is put out in case it spreads to your house. In addition, sort of systemically important non-bank financial institutions and holding companies will also be included in scope. Stabilization powers are to include bail-in, transfer of assets and liabilities, as well as creation of bridge institutions. These are all tools that have been deployed in some form previously in other resolutions, including an African bank. But the proposals here seem to seek to make these clearer and apply them more consistently. In addition, we will establish a resolution authority, which will be in the Reserve Bank or the Reserve Bank, and they will be responsible for the development of resolution plans as well as designating SIFIs. Lastly, there will be safeguards to include a new proposed creditor hierarchy, and we will go this in, we'll go into this in more detail in slide 15. An important creditor protecting tool in this is a no creditor worse off principle, which we will go into as well, I think, in more detail when we get into the creditor hierarchy slide. All right. So I'll just go through the resolution framework and what it seeks to do, and this has largely been covered in the previous slide, but I'll also go through the specific powers and functions that the Reserve Bank has. I'll perhaps go through that first, as I've broadly covered the framework. So the powers and functions of the Reserve Bank are five main ones, and the first is the power to remove and replace management and recover monies from those responsible for the failure. This includes where a measure to sort of reduce some of the moral hazard that we described earlier. So for management of a financial institution or a bank, very often they have an incentive to create as much money for their shareholders as possible. And this usually requires taking on more and more risk. But clearly, the more risk a bank takes, the more likely it is that they will, that this will lead to failure, and that the funds of ordinary depositors will be placed at risk. To reduce this moral hazard, a part of this moral hazard is that the staff or senior management of financial institutions receive large bonuses and incentives to increase the profits of financial institutions, and so there will be a power included in the framework that will allow a clawback of bonuses paid where executives have taken on excessive risks, which in part or completely led to the failure of a financial institution. Secondly, there's a power to terminate, assign contractual agreements, and this is really to provide financial institutions with the space to identify critical functions and to resolve a financial institution in an orderly manner. Third, there's an appointment of resolution practitioners with delegated powers, and this is largely akin to the current curatorship powers that exists in the Banks Act. But of course, as we said earlier, that these will be extended beyond just to banks, but also to the broader to other designated SIFIs. Fourthly, the power to establish bridge institutions and transfer selected assets and liabilities. And this really allows the preservation of critical functions that I described earlier. And lastly, power to take in bail in action while respecting the hierarchy of claims in liquidation. Like I said, I've gone through the resolution framework, but very quickly, this is just maintaining financial stability, depositor protection, allowing for an orderly resolution of designated financial institutions, management of affairs of a designated institution, ensuring critical functions of designated institutions continue, resolution planning, and empowering the minister to place a designated institution in resolution, which is currently the case for banks, but again, will be extended to other SIFIs. Okay, I'm just going to skip through to the changes or the proposed changes to the creditor hierarchy. Currently, we have three levels, three creditor classes for banks. These are unsecured creditors, and in there there are a bunch of other creditors, but also ordinary depositors. Above them, there are preferred creditors. And then above them still are secured creditors whose loans are backed by specific assets or ring-fenced by specific assets on bank balance sheets. Clearly, in the current formulation, if a financial institution or bank had to be resolved, we could not differentiate between ordinary depositors and a whole host of other unsecured creditors in law. And what that means practically is that the ordinary depositors occupy the same place in the queue to be compensated as all these other creditors, and that place in the queue, as you can see, is somewhere near the bottom. So the bill proposes to have additional layers of the creditor hierarchy, and in doing so, explicitly prefer depositors, moving them significantly further up in the queue to be compensated in the event of a failure, of a financial institution. The new proposed creditor hierarchy has at the bottom a class of regulatory debt instruments, and these instruments will be the ones to absorb losses first. Above that, we will have what we call first loss, or what we term first loss additional capital instruments, and this is a sort of additional buffer to further ensure that that there are that the creditors higher up are further protected. And then we have this unsecured class of creditors in that you see on the right hand side in the current formulation. And then we have covered deposits that we will describe earlier, and this is the ordinary depositors' money, essentially. And then similar to the current formulation, we have preferred and secured. We can take additional specific questions about the hierarchy later if members have any questions. So what is the policy rationale for the new creditor hierarchy? As I've sort of alluded to, the current SA creditor hierarchy does not recognize the distinction between ordinary depositors using banks for transactions and informed creditors and deposit making that more sophisticated financial institutions place within banks seeking to make an investment return. Second is the need to align the bail-in sequence for creditor losses, and this is the tool that allows for creditors to absorb losses or the resolution authority to impose losses on creditors rather than allowing or rather than having recourse to the fiscus. Third, bail-in together with the creditor hierarchy should allow for an ordinary resolution and, if necessary, winding up of facilities. Fourthly, creditor hierarchy gives due regard to sophisticated creditors, allowing those who have a more sophisticated understanding or those that are able to exert more discipline on the risk appetite of a financial institution, and these are larger institutional investors as opposed to ordinary depositors who are creditors but don't have the same ability to question the risk appetite or activities of the management of a bank. We don't have too many more slides, and I'll try to get through this last bit quickly, but I'm just mindful of the time. So just to continue on the policy rationale for the creditor hierarchy, a definitive creditor hierarchy will ensure transparency and avoid confusion. The type of confusion we had when we tried to resolve African Bank and had to hastily put through a bunch of clarifying amendments in 2015. I preferred this as ordinary creditors and those who bear the first loss, which in turn will lead to the avoidance of under or over pricing of risk. And then lastly, the need to align as a creditor hierarchy to international standards. In summary, there are four proposals. And these are first, secured and preferred creditors to retain their current ranking. The second, for depositor preference of covered depositors up to the coverage level of 100,000 rand per customer, per bank. Third, unsecured creditors currently recognized in insolvency to rank below current to rank below covered depositors. And lastly, the introduction of this extra loss absorbing class of creditor instruments, FLAC. These instruments are specifically identified as loss absorbing after regulatory capital. Fifth, regulatory capital requirements are designed to bear going concern losses. Lessons from the previous bank failure show that regulatory capital may be insufficient by the time SIFI enters resolution. Additional requirements for large financial institutions to hold instruments over and above regulatory capital for loss absorbing for loss absorption during resolution. And lastly, regulatory capital has to be available to absorb shocks and losses during normal times and prevent failure. If there's any regulatory capital left when a bank fails, the creditor hierarchy should ensure that the instruments identified as regulatory capital are the first in line to suffer losses in the event of failure. I'm now going to spend some time going through the features of the of a really important innovation that the bill seeks to introduce. As Momo described earlier, I think South Africa is the only country amongst current G20 members not to have a deposit insurance, an explicit deposit insurance scheme in place. It was ourselves in Saudi Arabia. I believe Saudi Arabia have introduced this now. So this has been long overdue. It is an innovation that seeks to protect the most vulnerable creditors in a bank. These are ordinary depositors who, like I said earlier, also have the least ability to exercise discipline over how a bank behaves and the risk a bank takes and the risk a bank takes. And I think and maybe just to underscore, this is we all sort of witnessed the anxiety that ordinary depositors had in the failure of in our most recent bank failure, which was VBS. These were long lines of ordinary investors, of ordinary depositors rather, who had placed their deposit in the bank, expecting the bank to safeguard their deposits. And these are the hard sort of earned deposits of ordinary investors and of ordinary depositors rather, excuse me. And this innovation seeks to protect these depositors. So I'll just go through the advantages of the deposit insurance scheme and what the insurance scheme aims to do. It aims to eliminate the risk of deposit losing funds that deprive them of their livelihoods. Second, it'll promote competition of smaller banks. And the way it'll do this is that the perceived increased safety of a big bank will be reduced because all banks, regardless of their size, will have the same amount of protection or provide the same amount of protection for ordinary depositors. Thirdly, it'll improve confidence and reduce risks of a bank run during a crisis. And this we've seen. So this is to reduce that the problems of panic and long lines of that happen whenever people hear that there may be trouble at their bank. Clearly, the rational thing to do is to go to your bank and try to withdraw all your money. This will be a confidence measure that will allow ordinary depositors to understand that no matter what, up to the coverage level of 100,000 rands, which by the way is close to something like 95 or maybe slightly less percent of average balances at a bank, those deposit funds are safe. I can get you the exact sort of coverage amount later if members want to know that. Fourthly, it ensures continued access to funds during a failure. Even if a bank fails, people have ongoing obligations. They have to pay for rent, school fees, cars, etc. So this will allow those payments to continue even in the event of a bank failure. It also minimizes the risk of contagion. It enhances South Africa's market integrity, which in turn ensures investor confidence. It will allow smaller banks' crises to be better managed with minimal disruption. Very importantly, it will protect the fiscus. The fiscus has had to bail out depositors in almost in certainly the last bank failure, BBS, and the one before that, African Bank, and ones before that as well. So this will protect the fiscus from that. It'll put the
Mr. Davidson, how far are you with your presentation? Remember, we have got 3 bills to process today, and by 12 we should be done. I know the ANC has got a caucus around 1:00. So if you can move faster towards conclusion.
Chair, we're almost done.
Yes, Chair.
So move faster.
Speak to the slides, because we have received the presentation before. And then during the discussions, members will raise questions for clarity and make comments, so that we have enough opportunity for the other 2 bills to be presented. Okay.
Certainly, Chair. I will go through the next 2 slides in a little bit of detail, and then rush along, because these next 2 slides are critical. I will just go through the structural features of the deposit insurance scheme. It is to be housed in the Reserve Bank. It's to be a subsidiary of the Reserve Bank. The membership of the deposit insurance scheme are to be registered licensed banks, all registered licensed banks. And the funds to consist of premiums collected, deposits by bank, and investment returns of these items. So the funding level is to the threefold. It's a levy, a premium, and a provisional liquidity line to the deposit insurance scheme. The slides goes into the sort of the specifics of the funding of the deposit insurance. I won't spend too much time on this as members have the slides. There are 3 very important design features. It'll establish information requirements. In other words, it'll have a single customer view. So whether a customer has multiple accounts, it will consolidate these accounts and then provide coverage to a customer on an aggregated basis. It will limit support for it will provide limited support, rather, for open resolution strategies. In other words, there may be circumstances where it is better, it is less costly for the deposit insurance to provide an amount of funds up to what it would have paid out to keep the institution going, and so it'll allow for that ability. And lastly, there's an emergency liquidity facility which is to be provided by the Reserve Bank as a backstop in the event of insufficient funding. So, Chair, that brings us to the conclusion of the presentation. In summary, the 2008 financial crisis exposed the regulatory gaps in global financial markets, and but especially for banks, which operate on a cross-border basis. And the moment described as doom loop, Large financial institutions, which are systemically important and deemed too big to fail, require additional tools for regulators to resolve cleanly and not to spill over into the broader economy. The regulatory framework requires a legal process that entails early intervention, crisis management, and crisis planning for an ordinary wind down. The bill introduces that. 2009, South Africa undertook to adopt a resolution framework in line with G20 peers. What is important is that other countries deem our regulatory system to be equally safe, or they will apply additionally stringent requirements on South African banks operating as counterparts because of inadequacies in our system. So this reduces the need for that. And lastly, we are taking on lessons that we had learned from African Bank and VBS and recognizing the need for additional powers and tools to intervene. And we are explicitly providing for a privately funded deposit insurance scheme for vulnerable depositors. Thank you, Chair. That's it.
Thank you, Chair. We're done.
Okay. Thanks, Treasurer, for the presentation. Honorable members, it's time for clarity-seeking questions and comments. Let me see if there are members in the platform who would like to ask clarity-seeking questions and make comments. Alan, you will assist me from your side.
Chair, for now, there is Dr. George and Mr. Hill Lewis.
And then, Honorable Morolo. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. On the deposit protection, I do think it's a good idea because, you know, many other jurisdictions also do that. It sounds to me as if it is basically an insurance type scheme, because what I'm hearing is that the private sector or the banking or the loaning institutions will pay for this. So I think it sounds like basically an insurance policy that gets paid by premiums. And then if it's managed by the Reserve Bank, the question is, what happens who underwrites that fund then? So let's say there was some kind of catastrophic event, which we hope wouldn't happen, but let's say it did, and there was insurance, which is a good thing, but there wasn't enough money in that fund. Who would actually underwrite it? Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. George. Honorable Lewis.
Thank you very much to the team. It was a really excellent presentation and very comprehensive and really puts one's mind at ease that this is an excellent initiative and a step in the right direction for South African depositors. It may have been covered in the presentation, but there were quite a lot of slides and it was quite long. But could you just let me know what the maximum coverage offered would be or the maximum covered losses? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Lewis. Honorable Morolo.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. Let me also appreciate the efforts that were put into drafting this bill. Just a few questions, Chair. My first concern is whether could this bill not be counterproductive in a sense that financial services institution, knowing that they have an insurance fallback position or rather act, behave in a more risky or unethical manner. The second question is, can a practical example be given? For instance, if a depositor had a deposit of 100,000, what would be the insurance cost of that deposit? And the third question is, does the introduction of this depositor levy not erode potential growth a depositor would have had. Well, maybe the last one, Chair, and I am also mindful of the fact that I had connectivity issues earlier, and this question would have been quite succinctly dealt with. Let's say if the funding structure is that the members fund a percentage of the insurance fund, would the bank not simply pass on the cost of this insurance on all their customers? Thank you very much.
Thanks. Let me also ask a question, Mr. Momo and Davidson. I see in your presentation you say in 2019, the South African Reserve Bank published a discussion paper on called Ending Too Big to Fail, South Africa's Intended Approach to Bank Resolutions. And you continue and say that there are major banks which are too big to fail, and you acronym it as TBTF. And this is why banks are often compared to nuclear facilities and described as a systemically important financial institutions. Are you implying that you will go all out and support very big banks and neglect small ones because they are small that they can fail? Only those which are too big should not be allowed to fail. Does this give us an impression that is the reason why government is not seen to be interested in assisting VBS? So banks like VBS will be allowed to collapse. You get Nedbank to pay off their clients, Itala and others. This, I'm not comfortable with this kind of a statement in a presentation by government, and it should go to Parliament. I'm not, because what you are saying is that the government will go all out and protect monopolies, and those which are very small can look for themselves, and even if they fail, no, it's not a problem. Give us the context of why did you write this thing in a presentation to us as Parliament. Over to you, Treasurer and Reserve Bank.
No, thank you, Chair. And Chair, I think the questions are actually excellent questions, because I think those are precisely the issues that we worry about. I mean, maybe just to explain and to start with Honourable Malalong's question, you know, and this is a dilemma in every country, Chair, that you get a few banks that are systemic. Now, there'll be the obvious big four, big five, etc. But frankly, we found even a bank like African Bank pose, you know, systemic problems when we had the problem, even though at the time, perhaps one would have thought they wouldn't. So it does cover quite a few banks. And I think, you know, I just want to explain, because I think in our explanation, we didn't explain what model hazard means. Model hazard means, for those members who may not know, that a bank starts taking risks. In fact, more risks, hoping or if they knew that if government's going to come in and bail them out, they will take more risks than they should, because and in a sense they're gambling. It's a casino, so they take huge risks, and if their risks prove to be work, they make a hell of a lot of money. And of course, the way the banking sector operates, they get big bonuses for management. If they fail, they then know that they've got a gun to government's head, and government will be forced to bail out, because you don't want the economy to go into meltdown, and the impact will be much worse on the poor. And that's why we say that the way the system, effectively any banking system, your profits are and bonuses are privatized, but your failures are socialized because the state is forced to come in. So yes, in order to prevent them from taking more risky bets, that's why, in fact, the words we didn't use in our presentation is all the G20 countries recognize that banks must be regulated, and these are their words, intrusively, intensively, and more effectively. So unlike other companies, I mean, the Prudential Authority, for example, would go into their books. They would thoroughly examine their business model. They would make sure that all their directors and top staff are fit and proper. They've got to also meet with anti-money laundering laws, which are quite draconian, and rightly so. So you, in the first instance, when there's a banking failure, yes, the big question is, are the regulators doing their job? And every time there's a failure, we always have some form of inquiry with an independent person to say, where was the fault? Was obviously the fault is with the institution, but were the regulators sleeping or not? And so to prevent moral hazard, you've got to make sure that we have quite intensive and competent regulators in place. So that's the only way that you can mitigate the risky behavior. The problem is, even without this legislation, that risky behavior is there. All this law does is to try and regulate it and reduce the risk to the fiscus. And so by having the insurance, everyone pays. So Honorable George, the question on this is that obviously when they start off, the fund will be small. So you hope that there's no financial crisis for a few years and you have a huge buildup. The bigger fund you have, the more you can intervene and save depositors when there is a bank crisis. That we will have more bank crises, that will happen, okay? You can't stop them. But to make sure that we are better prepared, if you look at the bank bail-in, and Bukile can explain that better than I, you'll see that all the mechanisms that there are to put that in place. And then, Honorable Chair, to your question, at the moment, we haven't bailed out any banks, whether they're big or small. And all banks, when they get into trouble, they go into curatorship. Of course, the problems, and so in the case of African Bank, we were able to, and you've got to kind of ride out the storm, because banking is about trust. You have problems. Everybody runs out. Everybody wants their money. Once you try and you manage to stabilize and have a guarantee on 100,000 and say for each depositor, you find that people start coming back to that bank. In the case of VBS, it wasn't that therefore government didn't want to save it. The problem was when we put it into curatorship, the aim was to save the bank. And then, of course, we found out the extent of fraud and the fact that there were actually no funds in that bank. And so it had to go into liquidation and so on. So and when a bank is in trouble, you hope that you have other sort of banks or other shareholders who potential or investors who come in to buy that bank. And in fact, in that case, I mean, people may put in bid, but they also have to pass a fit and proper test. And the issue with banking is that you can't borrow funds from another bank to buy a bank. You're largely, your major, because that creates more risk to the banking system. You actually have to be quite rich to own a bank and to have the capital on hand, a lot of the capital. Otherwise, the banking doesn't work. And that's not a South Africa-specific problem. I mean, this whole problem of moral hazard, of bigger banks posing more risk, is an international problem. And it's a dilemma because banks obviously do play an important role in the economy. And yes, if we had, we'd prefer to have more competition and many more smaller banks. But in a sense, given where we are, and Chair, let me say, this is a problem that if you look at, for example, our reports done by the FSAM, I mean, there's a lot of monitoring on how we regulate. The Financial Stability Board has a process to do so. The Basel process also has their own peer reviews that are done. If you look at, and then if you look at the IMF in their last report that was done, I mean, they showed that in our case, our financial system is more prone, has higher risk, not only because there's a normal banking risk and a few companies dominate and so on, but you'll find that the same companies also dominate insurance, both long-term and short-term asset management, et cetera. So the interconnectedness in South Africa is very high, and therefore the risk to the system is even higher. So the issue is not that we do not come in and save small banks. In fact, the deposit insurance will actually be much better for small banks. And that's been our concern, because most of the failures have been with smaller banks in recent years. And the deposit insurance system will mean that the big banks will effectively pay for an insurance fund that can be used to also save small banks. So it reduces the risk to the fiscus, and it makes it more possible to save banks. And as I said, where we can, we generally save all banks by putting them into curatorship, unless there's something that, like with VBS, where the scale of the fraud just made it impossible. And literally, you might as well, I guess, it put us into a situation that, you know, the good got thrown out with the bad because of the depth of the problem. I think just on, so the issue is not to protect monopolies, but yes, all over the world, you are going to step in to protect your banks. Because as I said, as one John Foster said, the consequences will be too ghastly to contemplate if one of your major banks collapses. There will be economic meltdown. And Chair, if you want to see what happened, I mean, look at when you had this Eurozone crisis, it started even with a small country like Iceland and what it meant for Iceland and definitely in Ireland and in Greece, where you saw the link between the sovereign and the banking risk and the years of real austerity. You want to see austerity? That became austerity. A huge budget cut. People lost their pensions. People, I mean, the hardship is dire, okay? And in fact, the only lesson you learn from a financial crisis is make sure you do everything to prevent one. And that's why, Chair, as Parliament, you must hold us and certainly the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority to account to make sure that they are regulating intensively so that we don't have obvious mistakes that should have been picked up. I don't know if Bukile wants to add on. I think I've covered Honorable Hill Lewis's question. And I think I've covered what the Chair has asked. But Bukile, you want to just come in with more detail?
Yes, Mama, thank you. I think, and I'm just going to, I will just pass on to the Reserve Bank as well to speak about the cost, the cents cost per rand covered. But just to answer a specific question that Honorable Lewis asked, the coverage amount is 100,000 rand. Per customer, per bank, on a single customer view basis. But Hendrik or Sabiha, would you like to go through the cost of the insurance per rand or per 100 rand in the deposit insurance scheme?
Thank you. Bukile, yes, I can quickly do that and just respond to a number of the questions from the honourable members. So is it an insurance type scheme? That's exactly what it is. Who will underwrite it in case there's not enough funds? So the funding of the scheme, the proposal is for three layers. So premiums from the banks. Secondly, there's a liquidity layer of deposits that each member bank need to deposit with the Corporation for Deposit Insurance. And then thirdly, there's a guarantee from the SARB, an emergency fund that the SARB provides in case there's not sufficient funds available for a payout. Then the maximum covered amount, as Vukuli has said, is 100,000 rand. Now, how did we arrive at 100,000 rand? So it's per qualifying depositor per bank, as Vukuli has said, and that might seem small compared internationally, but remember that intention is to protect the vulnerable depositor and not corporate depositors. So the 100,000 rand will be sufficient to cover the retail depositors. According to a survey that we've done, approximately 87% of qualifying depositors in South Africa have deposits of less than 10,000 rand. That would mean as you increase that amount, you add very small amounts of numbers of qualifying depositors. But, and Sabia can maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think with 100,000, you are covering more than 90% of depositors in South Africa. On the cost, and will the banks pass on the cost? Yes, although we do not prescribe how banks will recover these funds from their depositors, we've estimated that the average cost per depositor of deposit insurance across the sector, and this is according to a 2015 survey, will be around 7 rand per depositor. So fairly small, but again, to say that we're not prescribing to the banks how to recover the cost. Just one final thing, I think on the moral hazard, the honorable member's question on will it be contraproductive? Will it cause moral hazard? We have limited coverage. In other words, it's not unlimited for large depositors to receive this guarantee. So in that sense, it does not cause moral hazard. Will it erode potential growth? We don't think so, because through this scheme, we're trying to reduce the burden on banks as well, and especially the way in which the funding structure is designed. Yeah, I think that covers it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think we've answered all the questions.
No, okay. I think Mr. Momo, at some stage, we'll have to discuss the monopoly of the financial sector. It's a fact. It's not something that we are thumbsucking. The big four or the big five are there. It's known. And the entry by cooperatives, emerging and small players into the banking sector is made very, very, very difficult by the requirements from the South African Reserve Bank. We'll have to discuss the transformation of the sector. We can't only be discussing the regulations and the protections, and it ends there. The previously disadvantaged have to enter this sector and become major players. Otherwise, it means we'll kiss the transformation goodbye. Those who are monopolizing now will continue to be the only players. So we understand that you are bringing regulations, but at some stage we'll have to discuss real transformation of the financial sector. That's what we have to do And that's the reason why we have been elected to be members of parliament, because we represent women out there, the disabled and the youth, who have been disadvantaged in the past and continue to be disadvantaged by the system that we have. So it can't be business as usual. At some stage, the sector will have to be discussed, and we come with a real recommendations as to what needs to be done. It's something that should occupy our agenda. Let's move to the next item. Briefing by Dr. George on the Pension Funds Amendment Bill, B30-2020. Over to you, Dr. George.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm just wondering how we're going to do that. I have sent my slides to Alan, so if he's going to put them up, or I could share my screen. I don't know what's best.
Dr. George, I made you co-host, so you're welcome to project from your side.
Okay. Okay, is that clear?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Chair. All right, I've just got, yeah, okay, right. Okay, as you know, I have drafted the Pension Funds Amendment Bill. Right. As we know, pension funds are an important financial asset. The primary purpose of a pension fund is to provide for a member's retirement. Pension funds play a crucial role in our economy and have approximately $4 trillion in assets under management. We also have a strong, profitable industry that is built on pension fund administration and investment of pension fund assets. Let me just stop for a second. Oops. I'm having a difficulty here, Chair. I apologize. Right. Okay. Right. Pension funds are already leveraged. We have the phenomenon of pension-backed home loans. Funds are not forced to offer pension-backed home loans. Trustees decide whether the fund could make this facility available. They also acknowledge that there exists a trade-off between a member being able to live now and living in retirement. That's a conversation that's been going on for a very long time. For example, there is no point in being homeless when a member has built up assets in a pension fund that can assist in providing for personal safety now. Pension funds permit this facility. The trustees decide to make the facility available. The way it works is that a member borrows from a financial institution to buy a home or to make home improvements and repays the loan, usually via a salary deduction. Now, given that the loan is fully secured, the member should enjoy a more favorable interest rate. Given that the loan is fully secured, the financial institution has comfort that the loan will not become a bad debt. And importantly, no withdrawal is required and pension assets remain invested. So what is the Pension Amendment Bill amending? It is amending the restriction on pension-backed loans being available solely for the purpose of purchasing or improving a home. There is no restriction on the purpose of the loan. It sets a limit of 75% of the fund value for the loan. What remains is the trustees decide if they want to offer the loan. So the bill does not force a fund to offer pension-backed loans. The trustees still decide. The trustees also would be able to decide the loan limits. That is why I set the limit at 75, because the fund could decide what it wants to make available. The financial institution would decide if they want to offer the loan. So it's basically a similar mechanism to the currently restricted loan. Why now? The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted long outstanding issues. The role of pension funds in the financial life of individual members. Compulsory saving to pension funds crowding out shorter term saving. This has been discussed for a long time in that members are usually obligated to invest in a pension fund. And that does actually reduce the money they have available for investing elsewhere. So you have a sway towards the longer term rather than the shorter term. So that is a conversation that's been going on for quite a while. I mean, we all know the history of this, that there were mass conversions of pension fund arrangements from defined benefits to defined contributions that began in the 1980s and accelerated in the 90s. And in this process, investment risk passed from employers to members. And then from that, member investment choice evolved. And then home loans expanded member choice, as does this investment, this amendment. Also, obviously, not all funds are defined contribution funds. They are still defined benefit funds. But the principle underlying this bill is that members should be able to exercise a choice on whether they would be able to leverage their pension asset for their own benefit. COVID-19 pandemic further highlighted this problem, that members are resigning to access their pensions because they get into temporary difficulty, they see no other way out, and then they access their pension and have to pay tax on that withdrawal, as we know. Also, members facing severe current financial hardship despite owning a financial asset. How has government and or the industry responded? We all know that discussion on pension reform remains in progress, and it has been in progress for over 15 years now. Also, very clearly, the amendment bill has certainly stirred up a conversation. I've had 346 comments received. Many submissions were in favor of the amendment. I won't go into the detail of those. Some industry bodies and funds were not in favor. And amongst the key concerns raised were that pension reform is in progress, that it would create an administrative burden, that we have current high indebted levels in South Africa, and that there would be heightened expectations. On the pension reform process that is in progress, we do know that National Treasury, Industry and Labour are in discussion on pension reform, and this bill is not part of that process. My response to that would be that it doesn't have to be part of that process. There is the conversation going on about whether members would be able to access a early withdrawal with tax relief on it, etc. That's part of the conversation. But I'm specifically focusing for now on being able to leverage, a member being able to leverage their own money for their own benefits during a time when they need it to exercise freedom of choice. The administrative burden, the argument is that fund administrators would be required to expand their administration to facilitate the loans. This, of course, would depend on where the loans were offered. The bill does not force funds to offer it, and many funds do not offer home loans at the moment, but some do. At the same time, any change does present opportunities, so there are possible opportunities for service providers to develop a different model. We do know that the industry does have some big players in it. It is a profitable industry as far as I understand it. The fees are charged on funds are not insignificant. So if loans, also very importantly, is that if loans were not restricted only to home loans, the administration process would be easier. Because at the moment, if it is restricted only to a home loan, there is an additional step of paperwork that needs to happen, i.e. proof that this loan is in fact for a house or for a home improvement. Now, we do know from the industry is that there are times when members do all sorts of gymnastics so that they can actually get around that restriction. So by not restricting the loan, you would not have that hurdle to climb over and would be less administratively burdensome in that instance. The argument that members are already highly indebted. Well, of course, the National Credit Act imposes restrictions. I'm not proposing that the Act would fall away. I'm proposing that, I hear some noise going on there in the background. I'm not proposing that the National Credit Act wouldn't obviously apply. But the simple fact is that although there are many members who are over indebted, possibly, or indebted to the max, not everybody is over indebted. So that argument cannot be that everybody's in the same boat. They are not. Not everybody is over indebted. And also, something while I was doing my slides that I thought of is that, for example, if you have people who have borrowed money at very high rates, for example, we know what extremely high rates people get charged on short-term loans, for example, that perhaps this creates an opportunity for debt consolidation. So, for example, if somebody's paying an excess amount of interest, for example, on loans, that perhaps their pension fund could be leveraged in some way that would give them the benefit of a softer interest on existing debt. I mean, I haven't thought it through, but that sounds like a possibility. Heightened expectations. There is a concern that members would feel aggrieved if the fund did not offer loans because the law allowed it, but the fund can decide not to. That members might feel aggrieved if they didn't qualify for a loan, because if the fund does allow it, doesn't mean that they can, because the financial institution would decide whether they would qualify. And as in anything in life, I think expectations would need to be managed. In conclusion, that this bill is not a silver bullet. It is not designed to solve the economic crisis or financial woes of South Africa. I mean, we have very serious economic problems, as we know. However, in my view, it is a step in the right direction. Not every fund will offer loans. Not everyone will qualify for a loan, but some will. And this will enable a member to leverage their own assets to their own benefit. So the question is that should members be able to leverage their own financial asset for their own benefit? And my bill says yes, and so do I. Thank you, Chair. That concludes my presentation, and I apologize for the difficulties I was experiencing. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George, for your presentation. Let's invite members who would like to ask clarity-seeking questions and make comments. Over to you, honorable members. Alan, you will assist me from your side to identify members who would like to ask clarity-seeking questions and make comments.
Yes, Chair, for now there's no one.
Even from my side, I can't see any member who would like to make a comment. Treasury, do you want to make any comment? Not in a manner that influences the decision-making. Decision-making is ours. But at the end, remember, you are the lead department to implement this kind of an act. I mean, if this becomes an act of parliament, if ever there is any comment that you would like to make, and as I've said, not in a member to, in a manner to influence the outcome of the decision making, but you are a very important stakeholder because the act will come to you at the end of the day.
Yes, Chair. Thank you, Chair. We do have a detailed presentation, but not for today. As soon as you have hearings, I think that for us the issue is that the biggest problem we have is South Africans don't save enough, and we need to be careful not to throw the baby with the bathwater. The point is that South Africans are highly indebted. And, in a sense, your retirement savings are what's forced on you, because when you're employed through the collective bargaining and other arrangements, you're forced to put aside some money towards your pension. Our problem and the retirement reforms that we started in 2011 are designed, I think, to deal with many problems, because the biggest problem is members actually don't preserve their funds, and there's gaps, like they resign, as soon as they resign, they cash their money out. And so the broader reform is really, whilst we think that there is a role for some limited withdrawals, the bigger issue is to get preservation so people don't cash out each time they change jobs, to close that loophole. And I think that just on the borrowing side, there's also been a lot of abuse for those funds that allow it. I think Honorable George has touched on that. And whilst we're not closed to options, I think we have been in talking to NEDLAC, engaging, and one thing we've realized is there's no easy way out of this. And I think that the bill actually will invite more problems. And there's a number of considerations, and we are very happy to go through it in detail when we come and present, Chair. But we have big concerns on the bill from that perspective. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Momo, for your comments. As we have said, that at the right time, Treasurer will be allowed to come and make a submission in this regard. That's that. Unless Dr. George would like to make a closing comment on this presentation before we move to the next one.
No, Chair. I do look forward to the interactions that we're going to have in the future, because it is true, as the Treasury said, I mean, this is not a simple matter. And the whole issue of pension fund reform is not simple. That is why it's taken so long. But I think what is very good, I think, irrespective of where we end up with this bill, is that the matter is in fact brought closer to the forefront, because it does need to be done. And I'm very happy that I'm part of that process. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Treasury.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. George. Let's move to item 6, briefing by Honorable Lewis on the Fiscal Responsibility Bill B5-2020. Over to you, Honorable Lewis.
Thank you very much, Chairman and committee members. It's really such a pleasure to be able to do this today. I'm just going to share my screen. Can you see my screen now, Chair?
Yes, we can see the screen. You can proceed.
Great. So this is a briefing on the Fiscal Responsibility Bill, as you've said, Bill 5 of 2020. And it's a pleasure to be able to present it to the committee today. Firstly, what does the bill do? The bill introduces, for the first time in South Africa, a statutory fiscal rule, which is sometimes also called a fiscal anchor in some parts of the world. And a fiscal rule is, or a legislated fiscal rule, is a budgetary rule which every government has to comply with, which incentivizes or requires responsible budgeting behavior. This particular bill is aimed specifically at national debt. You get different kinds of fiscal rules. Sometimes you get a balanced budget rule. You get debt ceilings, like in America. And this one is particularly aimed at containing national debt and debt service costs. Now, you may ask, why do I focus on debt? Well, it's because debt is the most tempting thing for any government. Every government in the world faces relentless political pressure to spend more. And in recent days, we've seen, even in South Africa, this government is still under enormous pressure to spend more all the time on student debt, on student fees, on bailouts for companies, on higher social grants, on a basic income grant, on vaccines. And and so on. The pressures to spend are almost never ending, and that's not unique to South Africa at all. That is almost every democratic government in the world faces this enormous temptation to spend more than they should, to spend more than they beyond their means, and over time this results in a debt trap, and that's exactly what's happened in South Africa over the last decade. Each year we've just gone a little bit further and further into debt. And then you wake up a decade later and you have a major debt crisis. And this is not a comment, Chairperson, on the current government. This actually applies to all governments, present and future. We should want every democratically elected government in South Africa to behave responsibly with debt and to not allow debt to become the useful tool of political pressure in society. So the temptation is always for a government to borrow more now because they don't have to sort out the borrowing later. So you can always leave the problem to a future government, to a future finance minister, and ultimately to future South Africans, to future generations of people to pay off with higher taxes. So debt is like a drug in society because it is it's so easy to make it someone else's problem, and that is why it's so tempting, and that is why it's useful to have a legislated fiscal rule to help stop that. And as I say, this is for all governments, present and future. Right. The idea of a legislated fiscal rule is an idea whose time has come. Mr. Chair, if you look across the globe, statutory fiscal rules are increasingly being adopted everywhere. Even our own neighbors, Namibia and Botswana, have got legislated fiscal rules. And I've just selected a few countries that are, I think, relevant to our comparison, but actually there are many more, and I'm happy to provide a full list of countries who have adopted some form of fiscal rule, like Brazil, Mexico, Canada, Chile, Peru, Colombia, Australia. Many of those are middle-income countries exactly like us, similar social spending pressures, similar poverty pressures, and similar problems with debt sustainability. The OECD has recommended that countries should adopt fiscal rules. And they've said in a 2019 paper on fiscal rules that well-designed fiscal rules appear decisive in fostering long-term growth. So actually, fiscal rules are helpful to growing the economy because it gives everyone confidence that that fiscal policy will be more responsible in the future. And I've been pursuing this idea since even Minister Mboweni has said in 2018 that, and he called it a fiscal anchor, but it's essentially the same thing, new fiscal anchors may be required to ensure the sustainability of South Africa's fiscus, in addition to the expenditure ceiling. So we already have a kind of fiscal rule in South Africa, but it's a very loose fiscal rule called the expenditure ceiling. And so this is a proposal for a new fiscal rule aimed specifically at debt. Now, I was thrilled to see the response from the Treasury in last week's presentation, or 2 weeks ago's presentation, and I've included their slide in full, because it is there's very little on the slide that I disagree with, and it is basically in support of the principle of a fiscal rule. And I would just focus on those last bullet points. Introduction of a new fiscal law to be passed in Parliament in order to make it binding. That law must include escape clauses for extraordinary unforeseen events, like a multi-year recession or, for example, COVID. And that is basically exactly what this bill does. It also says that a fiscal rule must be clear and credible. And one option would be to introduce a debt ceiling. As I've said, I focus on essentially a debt rule. Okay. Let me just say a word about the scale of South Africa's debt crisis. And to quote the minister from his budget speech, we owe a lot of people a lot of money. I think that's a very simple but powerful line. If you look at by the end of the current MTIF, South Africa will be nearly five and a half trillion rand in debt. In 2 years' time, or in the, at the end of the MTF, we will spend 338.5 billion rand every year just on interest. That will be 60 billion rand more than we spend on basic education, 80 billion rand more than we spend on health, 90 billion rand more than we spend on social grants. That will be triple our total police budget and seven times our total defense budget, just on paying interest on our loans. It will be the biggest single item on the budget, bar public salaries. So for years, we have warned, and many people have warned, of this idea of squeezing out, crowding out basic services and basic expenditure. And for years, the Treasury has done a kind of miracle job in preventing that from happening. But this year, really, we saw for the first time very real cuts to basic services like social grants, healthcare, and emergency services. And so what we've seen coming, the train that we've seen coming down the track for years has eventually arrived, where it is no longer possible to continue to pay debt and continue to support all of the social services that you want. To continue to pay the interest on your debt. And so we've seen the one crowd out the other. And that has led an extraordinary statement by the FFC in our committee, which we all heard, questioning whether the budget is in fact constitutional. Now, regardless of whether we agree or disagree with that view, the point I'm making is that we have reached the point where interest expenditure is now fundamentally undermining our commitment to social justice and to caring for the poor and most vulnerable in our society. That cannot continue. So if our current growth, revenue, and debt targets are met, and I say that that is a very big if, then debt will stabilize at 89% of GDP in 2025. Now, just to give you an idea, the IMF recommends that a healthy or sustainable level of debt to GDP for middle-income countries like ourselves is around 50%. So we are already nearly 40 percentage points, or we will be nearly 40 percentage points above what is considered healthy and sustainable for a country of our income. And even now, as we face this situation where we are spending so much on interest, where we have relentlessly made the point, and the government and Treasury has relentlessly made the point about the danger that we face and how this expenditure is squeezing out all of the essential things that we should be spending money on, we still face massive political pressure to spend more. And we even have this this kind of faux debate around whether South Africa faces austerity or not. So still there is just a relentless pressure to spend more. And that is why I really believe that this bill, the fiscal responsibility bill, can actually be an asset to any government, because at least now it removes some of the discretion around going deeper and deeper into debt from the government, and you can almost fall back on the legislation as a reason why it is simply not possible to go deeper into debts year after year after year. So it could actually be helpful. Okay. Then the specifics of what this bill does. Firstly, it introduces a debt to GDP rule. The bill provides for a fiscal rule prescribing that for each financial year, consolidated net loan debt expressed as a percentage of GDP must not be higher than it was the previous year. And I want to say up front that this does not mean that the government cannot borrow. One of the objections, one of the less informed objections I've heard, is that this would stop the government from borrowing. No, that is not the case. As there are redemptions, the government is obviously able to roll over those redemptions. And as the economy grows, of course, that means that the denominator in that calculation, debt to GDP, grows. Therefore, debt can grow too. So it does not stop the government from borrowing. All it does is say that the net loan debt as a percentage of GDP should not grow. Two, a rule on government guarantees. The bill provides for a fiscal rule prescribing that for each financial year, aggregated government guarantees should not be more than they were in the previous year. That's self-explanatory. Three, it provides for a regular review. The bill provides for a review of the fiscal rules by the National Assembly, essentially by this committee, every 4 years by either amending, renewing, or terminating the fiscal rules by way of an amendment bill. I think it's important that it gives the National Assembly proper oversight power over the government's fiscal responsibility. I think that's a great feature of the bill. And then, as the Treasury said in their slide that I put up earlier, of course there has to be a provision for emergencies and unforeseen circumstances. So the bill provides for an exemption from the fiscal rule to be granted by the National Assembly on application from the Finance Minister, with good cause having been shown and with the support of the Standing Committee on Finance, this committee. So if there is another COVID, last year we borrowed 779 billion rand, and it's difficult to see how we couldn't do that in a crisis year. So if something similar happens, God forbid again, then this bill provides for the Finance Minister to apply for an exemption to the fiscal rule with the support of this committee. And finally, the bill requires the Minister of Finance to table an annual fiscal responsibility report at the same time as the tabling of the budget, setting out whether the fiscal rules were complied with or not, and the reasons therefore. Those are the five main things that the bill does. Honourable colleagues. Now let me just deal with one of the common objections I've heard. I've already dealt with one around stopping government from borrowing. This idea that it unfairly limits or constrains government's fiscal policy. What I would say is that the key tool of fiscal policy is actually tax revenue, not debt. Of course, debt is important and it should be used to fund investments, but fiscal policy space can still expand significantly with economic growth because growth leads to more revenue. And growth is strongly correlated, as Treasury has often made this case in our committee, growth is strongly correlated with sustainable debt path. So actually, by controlling debt, you can encourage growth, which expands fiscal space. And so I would flip this objection on its head and say, actually, this bill helps to expand fiscal space by underpinning proper sustainable growth. More than that, one of the explicit objectives of the bill is to limit any government's ability, present governments or future governments, to engage in irresponsible behavior or profligate borrowing with allowances for emergencies. And again, South Africa's economic growth right now is inhibited by our unsustainable debt trajectory and escalating perceptions of risk attached to our debt in global markets. So this actually helps address that problem and helps the economy grow, which increases fiscal space. There's a growing body of research on this, and I'm happy to recommend a lot of it to honourable members who may want to read about it. But I did find one very interesting paper which actually argues that far from constraining fiscal space, if anything, the fiscal rules that have generally been adopted are too weak to have any constraining effect. And that is clear to see in the American example. The USA has a debt ceiling fiscal rule, and nearly every year, Congress finds a reason to increase the debt ceiling. And so we have to be careful that it's not just a meaningless fiscal rule, that it actually has some bite to it, and that is the subject covered in this paper. But even if it is symbolic, it is nevertheless a very important symbol or signal that the government is absolutely committed to fiscal responsibility and debt sustainability. Chairman, just to conclude, what does this bill help South Africa do? It helps get our national debt under control. It will help to restore confidence in South Africa's economy. It will help to restore our sovereign credit rating. And it will help to ensure that future generations are not hobbled with trillions of rands in debt, higher taxes, and lower growth. It will help to stop a full-blown sovereign debt crisis with government unable to find new lenders. And it will help to stop a loss of sovereignty to international lending institutions. For that reason, I think it is a bill that we should be proud of. I'm certainly proud of it, and that we should support. And I recommend it to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Lewis, for your presentation on the Fiscal Responsibility Bill. Honorable members, we can engage with the presentation from Honorable Lewis. Questions for clarity, comments. Alan, you will assist me with members who might be on the platform and I cannot see them from my side.
Yes, chairs, nobody yet.
Okay. Are there members who would like to ask clarity-seeking questions or make comments in regard to the Fiscal Responsibility Bill? Okay. So now they are not there. Treasury, is there any comment that you would like to make in regard to this bill?
Chair Edgar Sishi from the Budget Office, I can come in if you permit me.
You are welcome, Mr. Sishi.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. So, just a few comments. As Honorable Hill Lewis indicated, we do have and have had for some years a fiscal rule in South Africa, which is the spending ceiling. But of course, it's not a law. It's a guideline, and it is true that it has weakened over time. Hence, some of the reflections and actions that we've taken in the last two budgets since budget 2020. But so that's an example of another kind of fiscal rule where you have a spending ceiling, which is currently a guide. This bill obviously proposes a statutory arrangement. There is another thing that has become a kind of a de facto fiscal rule. And by de facto, I mean it's become incidental to the fiscal realities of South Africa, and that's the financing arrangements. We have a rule around how we borrow in foreign currency versus how much we borrow in foreign currency versus what we borrow in local currency. To the extent that debt has become a bigger part of how government funds its spending, this year, 88% of government spending is being financed by taxes. The other 12% is debt in the current year, and that, of course, accumulates, and that's accumulated over the years. To the extent that that's the case, the fact that we have a rule that obligates us to borrow mostly in local currency has protected us from exchange rate risks and other similar risks. But so that's become a kind of a de facto rule, but it still comes back to the fact that its importance is only a testament to the fact that debt is so much bigger than it was before. Secondly, Just to also remind honorable members that fiscal rule can be important, but it does not replace the need for basic fiscal discipline. In other words, you have to improve your fiscal marksmanship, if I can put it that way, hitting the targets that you set in the budget. And the fiscal rule does not replace that and can't replace that. Indeed, if you have a statutory fiscal rule and you miss your fiscal targets, the consequences in terms of confidence and sentiment can be worse than if you didn't have the rule in the first place. So that's important, that it doesn't replace the need to make sure that fiscal discipline is maintained. The next point is that the rule should take into account, any rule should take into account the fact that the economic cycle will turn. In other words, if you set a rule on anything, whether it's on debt, whether it's on spending, or the primary balance or the fiscal balance, and the economic cycle turns from a downturn to an upturn. In other words, the economy starts to grow, tax revenue improves. There is a temptation to spend up to the limit that you had set before. So you have to have a mechanism for managing that risk of thinking about the economic cycle in an upturn rather than a downturn, because a rule under that's badly designed can promote pro-cyclicality. And then my penultimate point is to just indicate that one of the things that we consider, and we've made this point in our own presentations, is the fact that the composition of spending in South Africa, and indeed in a number of countries around the world, but certainly in South Africa, this is quite clear, that the composition of spending is to some extent a function of the protections that certain items of spending enjoy versus other items of spending. So for instance, there are very strong institutional protections for consumption spending, particularly the wage bill, but there's no institutional protections for instance, infrastructure spending or maintenance. Indeed, when there is pressure on the wage bill, budget managers typically take money from maintenance of infrastructure in order to pay the salaries. And I'm raising that point, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, to indicate the fact that you have to be aware of an unintended consequence where when you have a rule in place and people know that there's a global rule that must be met, that they use the unprotected elements of spending to shift funds so that they can stay within. And that means you've almost put the cart before the horse, in the sense that there is this problem of institutional protection that has to be addressed at the same time that you are implementing rules. And then finally, my last comment, Chair, is to just indicate that we have had reflections, discussions, and documents that we've written on some kind of fiscal anchors for quite a long time. These conversations have happened on and off. I remember seeing documents, discussions in Parliament on this subject as far back as 2009. So this is a subject that's not new. It's come up from time to time. One of the things that we have consistently indicated is that in order to build the credibility of any rule, and the lesson that we've learned from the challenges that we've experienced with the rules that we have had in place, is that you need fairly strong institutional arrangements. And in our presentation last week and in the slide that Honorable Hill Lewis showed, we did indicate in one of the points that we consider that if one goes in that route, you have to have some kind of institutional protections of the rules that you're putting in place. And you have to satisfy yourself that they can be utilized both in terms of its implementation, but more than that, advice on when changes may need to be made. That's not part of this bill, but that is an element that we have included in our previous discussions. Those are very general comments, Chair. of course, I've tried to keep to your instruction that we don't say anything that's designed to influence decisions. It's just broad comments. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Sishi, for your comments. Honorable Louis, any closing comments before we move to
thank you. Thank you, Chairman. I'm pleased to hear that Mr. Sishi has confirmed that this matter has been under discussion and consideration since 2009. I am shocked to hear. I only wish we had done something about it then when debt was at 20% of GDP and we could have been saved of the debt crisis we have now. But there's no time like the present, and it's never too late to do the right thing. So let's get on and do this now, 10 years later or 12 years later, but nevertheless, let's get on and do it now. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Louis. We are done with all the items. We are moving towards closure. Are there announcements, Secretariat? Alan, is there any announcement?
No, Chair, just tomorrow's meeting, PRC and AO and Independent Group and Mr. Maponya.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks very much, Honorable Members, officials from Treasury, Reserve Bank, and other stakeholders who are in attendance, and officials of Parliament, and all members present. Thanks very much. Until we meet tomorrow at 9 o'clock, the meeting is adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.